Talofa Lava, this is Tangata o Te Moana from RNZ Pacific. I'm Don Wiseman. And today, the fear Pacific countries are feeling amid the missile buildup, Samoa's quest to right a wrong, the impact of soaring cocoa prices, Tonga's happy for China's help, personhood for whales, and PNG's crickets on the rise. Pacific states at the centre of a brewing nuclear geopolitical storm, being urged to rely on diplomacy and unite with smaller states to hold the US and China accountable. In Asia Pacific, a nuclear policy expert's calling on smaller states to unite because he says we're on the cusp of a new missile age in the Indo-Pacific. There's been an increase in missile testing in the region, and the US military's newest long-range hypersonic missile system could soon be deployed to Guam. Alicia Foon spoke to Stanton Senior Fellow in the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Kit Panda, who says smaller states aren't completely powerless and must avoid being caught in the crossfire of a possible nuclear conflict.
For now about half a decade, we've seen the intensification of a security dilemma and an arms race in the Indo-Pacific region. The United States is largely reacting to increased threat perceptions from China, and China in turn is reacting to the United States. So this slated deployment of the new long-range hypersonic weapon, which may happen later this year in Guam in the Indo-Pacific, feeds into that broader pattern. So the U.S. Army has been thinking now for a number of years about how it can deliver tactical effects on the future battlefield, in effect, in the Indo-Pacific with new long-range missiles. And the broader context here is that in 2019, the United States exited a treaty known as the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which was agreed at the end of the Cold War in 1987, that used to limit the United States' ability to deploy specifically land-based long-range missiles that had ranges between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. So when that treaty ended in 2019, under the Trump administration, the United States began developing many of these new systems that are now slated for deployment to the Pacific in the coming years. So we are expecting the Army potentially later in the summer this year to announce that the weapon has reached readiness in effect and may then be deployed potentially to Guam. It is possible also that the United States will down the line discuss potential basing of either this missile or related new long-range capabilities that were built after 2019 on the soil of U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific as well.
And is it true that this missile could potentially reach Taiwan, parts of mainland China, and even North Korea if deployed to Guam?
Yeah, so there's an interesting question about the maximum range of this missile. The U.S. Army has not declassified the maximum potential range of this system. And just given the physics involved with a hypersonic glider, it is possible that this missile will be able to range deeper than has been publicly disclosed. And the reason the Army has disclosed a maximum range of 2,775 kilometers plus may be to avoid some of the more escalatory implications of publicly hinting that such a missile may be able to range, for instance, deep into China. But if you map that range out from Guam, let's say, you do end up covering Taiwan, but you do not actually end up deeper into China. But I do suspect that Chinese military planners will largely account for the possibility that this system could range much deeper into the Chinese mainland.
With these developments around long-range missiles, will Guam become more of a target to the likes of North Korea?
Guam would be essentially a target no matter what, in effect, because of its central importance for the United States' ability to sustain expeditionary military operations in the Indo-Pacific. But I suppose you could make the argument that Guam's strategic value more broadly to the United States is growing as a result of these new dynamics and new capabilities.
Many Pacific leaders want a Pacific zone of peace, but where it is placed geographically, is this even realistic?
Regarding your broader comment about a Pacific zone of peace, I do unfortunately think that the winds are blowing the opposite direction. But that's not to say that smaller states, Pacific Island countries with interests in seeing their region not essentially exploited for the purposes of geopolitical competition don't have any power. To the contrary, in some of my work, I've recommended that many of the smaller states who neither see themselves as aligned formally with the United States or China can actually take a much more forward-leaning position in calling for these countries to engage in arms control talks and strategic stability discussions more broadly. Now, we don't need to be fatalistic about the possibility of a conflict in the Indo-Pacific. These capabilities are being pursued largely out of an interest in deterring such a conflict. But of course, as we learned from the Cold War, deterrence without diplomacy is only a partial solution. And so I would like to see many of these smaller states putting forward recommendations that leaders of the U.S. and China take it upon themselves to recognize that they have a responsibility to avert war and at the same time reduce many of these dynamics that are turning the Indo-Pacific into a much more contested geopolitical and geographic realm.
How do smaller nations stand up for themselves and be taken seriously on the world stage?
Right. So, I'm not primarily talking about Pacific Island countries by themselves as a separate geopolitical unit. I was talking here more of countries, including countries in Southeast Asia. It is possible, of course, there is strength in numbers. And if Pacific Island states that do have concerns about the intensifying geopolitical storm that's brewing in Asia were to come together and identify the sources of what they see as geopolitical unease, that can actually have an effect of building pressure potentially that could then create greater incentives for China and the United States to engage in these talks. And I will say, under the Biden administration, the United States has been rather proactive in trying to engage China on arms control. But in effect, nobody's been willing to pick up the phone on the other side in Beijing. So this would also have to be something that the states see as worthy of raising on the diplomatic agenda with China, which, of course, is easier said than done with the case of particularly many smaller states that economically depend on not rocking the boat, so to speak, with either Beijing or Washington. I think there will need to be a specific call for the countries that are at the center of this brewing geopolitical storm to engage in meaningful risk reduction, arms control, and broader diplomacy to reduce the possibility of war in Asia. The stakes here are ultimately potentially nuclear conflict between two major superpowers with just existential consequences for humanity at large. And recognizing that, Asia and the Pacific, countries need to be willing to put this on the agenda very much in the way that many European states that were caught in the crossfire between the United States and the Soviet Union were willing to do during the Cold War in Europe. Of course, there's an imperfect analogy there, given that within the Cold War context, we had two bipolar alliances, and Asia today is a much messier spaghetti bowl, in effect, of diplomatic relationships. But a similar dynamic, I do think, fundamentally.
How will the U.S. election potentially impact what we're seeing in regards to missile launches in the Pacific region?
If Biden is reelected, I do expect we'll see more continuity, more efforts to engage China in good faith on arms control. And unfortunately, I think if Donald Trump returns, we'll see precisely the opposite and the intensification of militarism and U.S. contributions to arms racing dynamics in the Pacific.
A private members' bill that aims to restore New Zealand citizenship to people born in Samoa between 1924 and 1949 has passed its first reading in Parliament. But in a shock move, ACT and New Zealand First supported the bill from Green Party MP Teino Tuiono, while their coalition partner National was the only party to oppose it. Caleb Fotheringham has more.
The Samoan community erupted into singing in Parliament's public gallery last night when the bill got the votes it needed to get to the Select Committee. Reverend Aneteria Sa'u, the Secretary of the Samoan Ministry Fellowship in Wellington, says he's emotional about the outcome. He says the remaining elders deserve the opportunity to become New Zealand citizens.
For me, it's about trust, it's about fairness, and reinstate that citizen that belonged to our people. Why didn't they look after us in our first time? Why they reject our right as a citizen now? No, we were not looking for money, but it's about trust and fairness.
In 1982, the Privy Council ruled that all Western Samoans born between 1924 and 1948 were considered natural-born British subjects and were therefore also New Zealand citizens. However, the same year, the Muldoon government passed the Western Samoa Citizenship Act, effectively overturning the Privy Council ruling. Green Party MP Te Anau Toiono says his bill will give the opportunity for citizenship to no more than 5,000 people.
The cohort of people that we're talking about, they're getting older, you know, and the youngest of those elders that I was talking about is 75 now, and there's not that many of them left. So the opportunity to address this injustice is now.
Te Pāti Māori backed it, and to the House's surprise, so did ACT.
Madam Speaker, I want to just ease that member's nervousness by saying that ACT Party has decided to support this bill to select committee.
New Zealand First MP Casey Costello says it is important for her party that the bill is considered.
I've lived and worked most of my life in South Auckland, and we are enriched and blessed by the contribution Samoan community makes to our schools, to our communities, to our collective organisations.
Labour's Carmel Cipollone says supporting it is in the spirit of the Dawn Raid's apology.
Off the back of the significant contribution Samoans have made to Aotearoa, it is the right thing to do.
But National didn't support it, making it the first time the party has been outvoted since coming to power. MP Cameron Brewer argues the bill will set a problematic legal precedent.
The governments of the past, of many stripes, of many different colours, red, blue, green, Te Pāti Māori, others, have not taken this up. And we would argue it's because legally the arguments have been exhausted.
Mr Toiono hopes National will change its mind.
To be honest, I wasn't sure that the first speaker had actually read the bill. He didn't seem to have a real solid sense of it. Hopefully we can have better and deeper conversations with them through the select committee.
Reverend Sa'u is encouraging the Samoan community to reach out to their local MPs and ask them to back the bill as it moves to the select committee stage.
The price of cacao, or cocoa, has soared in recent months, as chocolate lovers everywhere will attest. In fact, the price has doubled in a year, and the impacts are dramatic. Una Brown, who styles herself the cacao ambassador while importing cacao, has also been working alongside Pacific communities to help them improve the quality of their product and to raise output. She told me about the effects the surge is having.
So, you know, in the cacao sector and in the Pacific, there's two real markets. One is the bulk market, and that's the market that buys and doesn't really care about the quality, the moisture content. And then there's the boutique market. Now, the boutique market normally paid double what the bulk market was paying. Now the bulk market's paying even more than what the boutique market was paying a year ago.
Really? For the PNG, Bougainville, Samoa, cocoa markets, that largely is to the bulk.
Yes, specifically Papua New Guinea, a huge volume goes to the bulk. Same with the Solomon Islands, and we've been endeavouring to raise the quality so there's a higher price in a sustainable way. Now, the boutique market is much more sustainable. It's more working with ethical chocolate companies and buyers who want long-term difference, where the bulk market is supplying into the commodities market.
Okay. So this might mean the cheapest chocolate is suddenly as expensive as the dearest chocolate.
Exactly, it is. But also what it means right now is that this price that the commodities market are willing to pay, it's actually what the farmers should be paid for being a cacao farmer. It's what the farmers should be paid by kilo. So it's giving a realistic indication of what chocolate should cost. So the chocolate industry and consumers have been benefiting, but the farmers haven't. And that's been the massive gap. So yes. Right now this price is actually reflective of a real price to the farmers, irrelevant of quality.
Yes, and we're talking about $6.50 a kilogram?
Yes.
US dollars?
No, not in US. That would be in Australian dollars.
$6.50, yeah. And that's what they should get.
That's what they should get. And then premium chocolate can be higher than that. But that's not at the farm gate in terms of that's what freight on board would be. You know. Yes. So then the aggregators will pay a slightly lower price at the farm gate to then ship it to the ports.
All right. So these people who haven't had any money in a long time are getting some, but it's having a lot of quite negative impacts.
Yeah, so like I really like to stress that on one level it's really positive in terms of actually a real price being paid, but also then this is going into communities and cultures where there's not used to having a lot of money. And if that money can be reinvested into the farm, into rehabilitation of trees, into long-term expansion of the farms, that's fantastic. But when you haven't been paid a good price for a very long time, like any of us, we suddenly have money in our bank account, we're going to want to spend it and, you know, and enjoy that.
Is that what's happening?
That is definitely what is happening. But also there's a lot of buyers coming out of the woodwork, I would say, who weren't buying for a long time. They might have an export and license and now they're going out there, they're buying up beans that would have been bought by ethical long-term strategy projects. So there's a lot of Wild West happening that's not healthy. And this is what happens when you have a sudden peak price in any commodity. All kinds of non-healthy play happens.
So the solution, as you see it, is what?
Well, the first thing is to hope and let, because, you know, consumers have such a voice of power. So if consumers understand that cacao farmers should be paid a healthy price, like around 450 to 550 New Zealand dollars, for example, per kilo, then they have to pay more for chocolate and to enjoy chocolate for it to be in any level ethical. So that this price increase stays, it doesn't drop down. And what we've seen happened 10 years ago, the price goes up crazily and it drops. It doesn't stay at this price level. Now, we need this price to stay and for the chocolate world to change in terms of less is more and high quality, and not just high quality, but for consumers to understand what it really is to be a cacao farmer and to be paid a proper price. But what happens is that, like, there's massive stores of cacao around the world that we don't even know about, you know, because it's bought in futures, it's stored in warehouses, it lasts for years, and those stores are depleted. So there's massive buying to refill those stores. Now, come 12 to 18 months' time, if those stores are full, what we'll see is a price crash. And we also have a lot more farmers getting involved, starting to harvest their trees because they're actually getting a real price. We don't want to see that price crash in 18 months. We want this to stay consistent. And in order to do that, because we're talking about the world stock exchange market, right? So it goes up and down in everything, all shares, everything. So for the Pacific, specifically for the Pacific, what we want to do is over the next 18 months, work with the farming communities to increase their quality. So even if the World Stock Exchange market goes down, we will still be able to get that price for the farmers.
Because you'll be able to sell at boutique price.
Exactly, right? That's a long-term, strong strategy that's not affected by the world stock market, because you've got buyers who build relationships and who look at the long-term and actually care about the farming communities on the ground.
We've had a report recently from the Australian National University, and I've been looking at cocoa farms in PNG and come to some grim assessments in terms of it's a very old labour force. The youth are disinclined to be involved. The quality of the plants, of the trees, is very poor. The industry is teetering and has been teetering for a generation. You no doubt see that sort of thing. Well, what do you think needs to happen?
And I see that across the world, because people ask me, are we going to run out of cacao? And I say, we'll run out of cacao farmers first, because the average age is late 50s and the youth are not interested because it's hard work in the heat of the tropics, and traditionally the price hasn't been worthwhile.
So a decent price will make all the difference.
One, a decent price, yeah. So that's one ground. But price is not everything. What has to also happen is pride and connection to their crop. So what happens throughout the Pacific, apart from Samoa, who use their own cacao and have their own local market. So you go to a stand in Samoa, like a market stand, and you'll see cacao beans for sale. And they drink what they call Cocoa Samoa every day. That does not take place in Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, or Vanuatu. So these farmers in the villages are meant to harvest quality cacao and put it in a sack when they don't know what that is, where it's going, what chocolate is, or even that Milo contains those beans. So there's such a disconnect. So they know good pineapples, good pawpaw, good taro, because they consume it. And they ask a proper price for that. But with cacao, they have no connection whatsoever to what that crop is. So there's no pride.
But there are efforts, and they've been underway for a while, to produce chocolate. And we've had chocolate events in Bougainville, I know, and in Solomon Islands. Yeah. And I think you also were introducing them to a version of Milo.
Yeah, so for me, it's not just about chocolate and the understanding it goes to chocolate and it goes to chocolate overseas, which is can be called like white man's food. It's about them understanding it's part of their diet. It can be part of their diet. The cacao bean, the cocoa bean, is actually one of the highest source of magnesium, plant-based iron, antioxidants. So it's extremely healthy. And when they given the opportunity and the invitation to have it themselves, it just changes everything because the relationship changes. So that's one of my passions and endeavours, is to have the potential for every farming community to understand the history of cacao, the health benefits, and how they can have it in their village with any special equipment, which is just by pounding. We roast the beans over a fire, we peel them, we make cocoa tea from the shells, and then we hand pound it into a paste. And if you add sugar, it becomes chocolate. If you don't, you add, you know, like we go and we get wild cane sugar, we squeeze that into the pot of bubbling cacao, cocoa, hot chocolate, and we make local Milo, in effect. And this is the first time that these villagers have tasted their own cacao, even though some of them have harvested it for over 100 years, which is sad, but also the potential for change.
Tonga is considering an offer by China to supply motorcycles and vehicles to its police force in support of the kingdom's security preparations for the Pacific Islands Forum later this year. It's raised concerns about Beijing's influence in the regional event. But the Tongan government staunchly defending relations with the superpower. Whenau Whenua has more.
Tonga's Prime Minister Huakava Meiliko confirmed at a news conference in Nuku'alofa last week that he had met with a delegation from China and that an offer was put on the table. When questioned about the appropriateness of a non-foreign member influencing the events, Huakava Meiliko dismissed concerns.
There's no reason to be concerned. China is offering to assist with the hosting of the forum leaders meeting. Then we've discussed, example, the numbers of police motorcycles and also supporting vehicles.
Australian opposition lawmaker Simon Birmingham has publicly called on the Albanese government to do everything it can to prevent China influencing the hosting of the forum leaders' gathering. Huakava Meiliko was also questioned about the issue in Parliament, where he defended Tonga's relations with Beijing, saying both countries had always assisted one another. RNZ Pacific correspondent in Tonga, Kalaf Moala, says the government is wary of any hostility its engagements with China would cause to other regional powers.
The concern here from the government is that this visit was going to be turned into a situation like questions were asked some time ago concerning the Solomon Islands and their engagement with China. And so it seems like that there are obvious tensions that are taking place with the superpowers, the West, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States concerned about Chinese presence in the Pacific.
The frustration of Tonga's government has been highlighted in a Tonga Foreign Affairs Ministry briefing that was leaked to ABC News. ABC says the 5-page strongly worded assessment written by Tongan officials describes New Zealand's response to the Solomon Islands China security deal as, quote, nothing short of frantic. It says the document states Australia and New Zealand remain far removed from Pacific realities and only echoed condescending rhetoric. Massey University professor Anna Pauls says it's no secret that Pacific governments are annoyed.
I don't think that the sentiments expressed will surprise anyone in the region, because we've certainly heard similar comments made over the years regarding frustrations towards Australia and New Zealand and the way in which the two countries sometimes conduct themselves in the region.
RNZ Pacific has contacted the Tongan government and New Zealand's Foreign Affairs Ministry for comments.
The Forum Leaders Summit is scheduled to take place in Tonga in August. Traditional Maori and Pacifica leaders have signed a declaration seeking to grant Wales legal personhood. The declaration seeks to protect the rights of whales to migrate freely, salvage dwindling populations, establish marine protected areas, and set up a dedicated fund for whale conservation. Tiana Haxton has this whale tale.
He whakaputuanga Moana, signed by Aotearoa's Kingi Tuheitia and the Cook Islands' Kaumaiti Nui Tu'uariki, aims to give whales, or to'ora, more robust protections that are recognised internationally. Travel Tu'uariki says the entire body of the House of Ariki supported the declaration, acknowledging the cultural significance of whales as well as their role in the ocean's ecosystem. He says as people of the ocean, Cook Islanders have a responsibility to protect the creatures that dwell within.
Because this ocean belongs to the people of the Cook Islands. The whale is very important to all of us. So that's why we stand up to protect the resources, to maintain that, to look after what we have in our ocean, in our EEZ.
Earth Council Alliance Chairperson Lelele Laulu says whales are highly regarded figures in the myths and legends of many Polynesian cultures.
The tokora were the spirits that led the canoes to their ultimate homes. Therefore, they're very, very important to them. Whales are much more revered in Polynesia. So this is what is very significant, that the Polynesian leaders themselves adopted this declaration.
He says the legal personhood will preserve the tohora's mana and integrity by working towards internationally recognised conservation for whales across the Pacific.
But giving them personhood means that now they have rights, now they can people can sue on their behalf in the courts of law, and they can be much more carefully protected, whereas before they didn't have any rights at all. They were just a bounty of the ocean and open for anyone to do anything with them.
Nan Hauser, who has been researching Cook Islands whales for the past 3 decades, says she is proud of the Indigenous leaders for taking a stand for the conservation of Tu'ora across the region.
It gives a really big statement and personhood to these whales that travel to the Southern Ocean to feed in Antarctica. And I'm hoping that it will be a voice that will protect them.
After 23 years of advocating for legislation, Hauser says this is a step in the right direction. The declaration has also gained significant interest from other countries. A big signing event of He Whakaputuanga Moana is expected to be held at the inaugural gathering of traditional leaders in Hawaii in June this year. Both Tu'uariki and Kingi Tuheitia have confirmed they will be attending. They say they are looking forward to connecting with Pacifica leaders to ensure whale songs will continue to resonate throughout Te Moana Nui o Kiva for generations to come.
The Papua New Guinea Barramundis are going to the ICC Men's 2020 World Cup in June. They have a tough pool, where the West Indies, New Zealand, Uganda and Afghanistan will be the teams to beat. Head coach Tadenda Taibu and Cricket PNG Chief Executive Officer Richard Doan spoke with Ilia Satoru about the team's preparation and how the game is surviving in a rugby league bad country.
Taibu says the team is preparing well at home, working on areas they identified from a recent Asian tour where they played a total of 14 games.
The preparations have been going good. We went to India, we went to Chennai, then from Chennai we went to Oman. From Oman we went to Hong Kong, played a series there with Hong Kong and Nepal, and then we finished up our tour in Malaysia. So a total of 14 games over a month and a half, which always is great preparation when you're building up a team for a World Cup.
The team head coach believes the team can go past the pool stage at the event as they focus on becoming a well-rounded team.
We can go to the next stage. Players are really looking forward to it and are really positive, and we are all positive about getting results, especially against teams that are ranked higher than us. There are a few things that we have started working on. It's really exciting. The changing room is really happy. And once we pick a few things on the batting, I think we'll be a well-rounded team.
While the Barramundis are ranked 19th, behind the 4th-ranked New Zealand, 7th-ranked West Indies and 10th-ranked Afghanistan, cricket PNG boss Richard Donne says they are going to the West Indies to compete and cause some upsets.
Of course, the big story for us this year is the Barramundis, who our men's senior team, who go to the World Cup. You know, we've got West Indies, interestingly, we've got New Zealand. We've also got Afghanistan and Uganda in that group. So, you know, we're planning on upsetting, you know, a couple of those teams and trying to move forward to the next stage of the tournament.
Meanwhile, Donny says their pathways developed and implemented at home enables them to produce cricket players, despite the fact that rugby league is the major sport in the country.
In terms of the junior pathways, very strong. We've also introduced this year, we've gone back to having our national championships for the women and the men, both at 40 over and T20, and we're trying to develop our pathways within those regions so the kids have a clear pathway to what it's like to get to the top of the game.
And that is Tangatua Te Moana from RNZ Pacific. Thanks for joining us. If you'd like to find out more, you can check our website. That's at rnzi.com. Until next time, tofu.